Survival Podcast is always one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, and it is July 9th, 2026. This is episode 3867 of the Survival Podcast, and given that it's a Thursday, it's our final show of the week, and we end with a bang. We end with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. And I've got a lot of great information for you guys today from a really good spread of the expert council. Some we hear from all the time and some we don't hear from quite as often. Got six topics for you today, so we'll give you plenty of variety. We'll open up as we usually do. I'd say 99 out of 100 shows we open up on the expert panel anyway with Dr. Ron Paul and either Dan McAdams or Chris Rossini or a special guest sometimes. Today we have Dan and Ron, and they're going to talk about how U.S. Foreign policy is a perennial failure, and they're going to talk about European foreign policy also being a failure, but we had a lot to do with that, and a lot of what they're saying is stuff I told you a long time ago. Then we'll move on to Dr. Bones. He's going to talk to somebody that's having some issues with thyroid health. Diagnosed with nodules on her thyroid, and anytime you hear nodules, that's always kind of concerning. In this case, it doesn't look like it's a cancer thing, but it's still something concerning, and doctor's going to help out with that. It's something to look out for, too. It's one of the things that's way more common, I think, people realize, to have issues with thyroid. Then Ryan Steve will talk about building a battery backup system for specifically freezer here. But this will be helpful to anybody that wants backup power. And he even has a very extensive list of materials. I do have linked in the show notes today. And then we have choosing a program for health and fitness that will work for you. Of course, that'll be Andy McCann. Then Chef Ken Daniels will tell you what a Juneberry is and what you can do with it. I have a few additional thoughts. It was a great segment. And then I've been asked a question about prompting in AI specifically for Notebook LM. And this is something I've been doing a great deal more work with lately. It's not stuff that I've shared very much so far, but that is about to change. So this question jives really well. And I believe that even if you don't do anything from a standpoint of like push out marketing business, like if you don't do anything with Notebook LM like that, you don't run a business, you're not trying to make a point, you're not using it to generate things for sharing, you just want to learn more, it is one of the most valuable AI tools that we have today, especially if you know how to use it and if you know how to combine that use with other AI tools. There is so much information out there that we want to take in. But here's the thing. Well, I'll just save it. I'll just save it for my segment because I think it is an incredibly powerful learning tool. And I'll give you a couple ways that you can use it, how to build some stock prompts and things like that. With that, before I bring Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on, I want to remind you guys, Laws of Life Book 2 is now available. In fact, Laws of Life Book 1, second edition, and Laws of Life Book 2 are now both available. Even if you have the first edition of Laws of Life 1, you really want the second one. Trust me. Everything you could complain about in the first edition is fixed. There's an additional 20,000 words of content. There's framework formulas. There's chapter distills. There's a whole plethora of quotes that are included that expand the context. Every chapter ends with mental code rewrites. And the second book is another level, another level. I have just pretty much finished the workbook for book one today. I'll be talking to Tom about how we're going to put some things together for resources on the Jack's Laws website for that this evening, and we'll go forward with that. And I'll be by Monday, I'm going to be writing the workbook for book two. It should take about 3 weeks, maybe four. So by August, we should have both workbooks out. These books, I can guarantee you the things in them work, and I can guarantee you that because they worked for me. And what I mean by that is I'm not the super special person a lot of people seem to think because I have a successful podcast. And not everything I did in life, I just touched it, it turned to gold. I'm not saying I don't have some Midas touch or something. I have the same flaws as every other man on the planet. I've made many mistakes, and I worked really hard in my life because the one thing I did know is that I wanted more than I had. And I determined these ways and means by which to get ahead and maintain ethics at the same time. And the fact that it worked for me means it'll work for anyone. It's kind of like building a fire. Once you know how to build a fire, you can teach somebody how to build a fire, and anybody can build a fire. It's not a complicated thing. It just has a process and an order, right? You have tinder and kindling, right? And then you have small fuel and large fuel, and then you need to make sure airflow, and then you apply flame, and you get a freaking fire. You don't have to be a genius, but you do have to follow a procedure. And I know you might think, hey, everyone knows how to make a fire, Jack. No, they don't. I remember very much being at like a church function one time where they were doing like the, you know, outdoor movies and stuff like that, and watching four grown ass men around a barrel try to build a fire to get rid of old wood and stuff like that. And because it would be cool and the kids could come over and do marshmallows and stuff. And I remember one of them leaving to go to the store to buy a fire log. And of course, by the time he got back, there was a raging fire because I went and built a fire, right? Does that mean I'm smarter than those other four people? I guess I'm smarter about how to build a fire, but no, it doesn't. You know, one of them could have been a neurosurgeon or something, for all I know. They just didn't know that particular set of steps to get that particular thing done, probably because no one had ever taught them before. The things that are in the laws of life books, I just want you to understand this, guys. I killed myself for 20 years of my life to learn those things, to build success, to become a regional vice president of sales for a $500 million company by the time I was 28 years old, without college. And I had to learn these things on my own. As I've been building the workbooks and I've dug deeper into neuroscience, I've learned more about why they work. And it's pretty fascinating. I invite you to get your own copies of the book. I really encourage you to get the hardcover copies. That will cost you more, and I'll make less. It's such a better experience. I have obviously all of them here. Or you can get the audio or the Kindle version. But if you're going to buy a print copy, I would go with the hardback copy. Like I said, I make about 50 cents less a book that way, but it's a better experience for you. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it. Let's hear about U.S. foreign policy. I like the term perennial failure. That title came from Chris Rossini over there, who puts these together for us, and it's often included in the Though Not Today. And I wonder if we just had a little bit of influence on using the term perennial there with all our permaculture and gardening talk. Anyway, with that, let's hear about this from Ron and Dan.
The idea that the neocons had at the time was that we can finally take out Russia. We're going to use Ukraine. It may get ruined, but that's too bad. We're going to use Ukraine as a tool to destroy Russia. Well, it hasn't happened. And in fact, ironically, Europe has destroyed itself. The deindustrialization of Germany, the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines, the end of cheap Russian gas that was powering the European economic machine. All of this has been the defeat on the part of NATO and particularly of Europe.
That's right. And I was always hopeful because there was a lot more economic activity between the two parties that there'd be less of this warmongering. But, you know, I think this special revelation of what went on and how we were involved is more clear cut than most of the coups. But this was a coup and our government was very much involved. It was recorded.
But the other thing about the Ukraine-Russia war is that it's very much like the Iran war in that the neocons promised this plan will work. We will be able to take out Russia finally and get rid of Russia as this massive state, massive power. We're going to break it up. Just follow the plan. Well, they did the same thing with Trump on Iran. Iran is about to fall apart. All we need to do is kill its leaders and we will take it out. Neither of the two have worked. You would think, after being wrong every single time, that the neocons would stop having the ear of people in positions of power, but I haven't seen any evidence yet that they have suffered at all for being wrong all the time.
This is one of those segments I have nothing to disagree with at all. I just maybe want to reinforce some things. And I want to talk about the one word a little bit there and how much of this there has been that has been at the direction of the United States, either indirectly, like we had somebody else do it, or we literally made it happen. And that word is coup. Most of the problems that we're dealing with revolving around Ukraine and the surrounding region right now go back to a coup that we caused in 2014. It really can go back into the 90s, the late 90s and early 2000s, and there's more than one example, but the big thing that we did, that we put our thumb on a scale that we should have never touched, was when we overthrew, not the Ukrainian people, we manufactured a coup in 2014 and deposed a duly elected president who was friendly toward Russia. Why? Because we got to get rid of Russia. Why do we have to get rid of Russia? What has Russia done to you? What has Russia done to your family? What has Russia done to your wealth? Has any of your wealth gone to Vladimir Putin? Or has your wealth gone to your own oligarchs here in this country and Ukrainian oligarchs? These Ukrainian oligarchs are out buying $200 million freaking estates. They're buying freaking $500 million freaking shit. They're buying freaking multi-million dollar yachts, all with your money. Well, we stopped giving them money. Trump makes the Europeans buy the weapons. Yeah, fine. They still took the money. And this whole line that you're hearing now, well, actually, like the big fat guy with the glasses pushing them up in the meme, right? Well, actually, Ukraine is turning the tape. No, they're not. That's all bullshit, too. Yeah, they bombed some shit in Moscow, and they got their shit pounded in for it. And that is going to continue. And there's no way you're going to break Russia's will or anything like this. And it is a problem. It's not a problem. We need a problem, so we are manufacturing one as though the communist Chinese are not an actual problem. But it is preposterous. If we would simply make the slightest attempt to have good relations with Russia, we would have good relations with Russia. Well, Jake, you can move to Russia and live under Putin's... Look, I didn't say Russia was a perfect freaking place. That is not the goal of foreign policy, to turn other people into copies of you. By the way, we've been turning ourselves into copies of other people, and it's not going real well for us. No, the goal of foreign policy is for everybody to get along, stay in their own wheelhouse, do their own thing, and stop fucking with everybody else's stuff. And the number one way to do that, and that's why Dr. Paul said he was so encouraged and then disappointed, is commerce. Is commerce. And commerce that is open commerce that is two-way. You cannot have commerce and not have a severe imbalance in time if the commerce is always country A's money going out and country B's thing coming in. You have to have some level of mutual exchange beyond just capital from one side and material from the other. That is the big imbalance and the big problem we have with China and, by the way, the EU. We could have an incredibly balanced and productive trade relationship with Russia tomorrow. But the people that are in charge of you, the people that run your lives, the people that design your life unless you do it for yourself, they don't want that. These same people are crapping on Trump for attacking communism, and they're still acting like it's 1984 with relationships with Russia as though they're the Soviet Union. You wonder why people are screwed up? Because the messaging is intentionally scrambled, and your brain can't make sense of it. And the only way for you to actually counter that is to stop trying to make sense of it. From a standpoint of why would they do this? Well, the purpose of the system is what the system does. And this is what the system is doing. And so the only defense mechanism is to stop trying to look at it rationally, as though there's any attempt to actually do the right thing for the people. Start looking at it from a standpoint of, this is the way things are. The way things are more important than the way they should be. And this is my lifestyle design that I need to bring to the table here, because they're not going to fix it. None of this is going to get any better. We don't talk about it because we're going to go fix it. It is well above all of our pay grades, including Dr. Paul's, to fix the problems in Europe with Russia and in the Middle East. And the people in power have no interest in fixing the problem. None. That's reality. All right, let's move on and talk about something a little bit more close to home. Let's talk a little bit about thyroid health with Dr. Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, plus designer of an entire line of quality medical kits at altonfirstaid.com. Today we have a question from Jonathan, who writes, what are the side effects or complications of an enlarged thyroid with nodules? I'm a male in my mid-40s. I'm pretty active. I've had no prior health issues and not on any medications. About 2 months ago, I noticed that if I looked down and swallowed, it felt like the Adam's apple was sliding under something, almost like having a snug shirt collar. I went to the doctor, and she could feel nodules on the thyroid. The doctor asked if it hurt, if it was painful to the touch, difficulty of swallowing, breathing. Answer was no to everything. I had 2 blood tests a month apart and an ultrasound. The first blood test showed the thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH, of 0.245, which is low, but the free T3 of 4.0 and free T4 of 1.3 being in normal range. The second TSH was 0.303. I went to an endocrinologist to review the ultrasound, and he also performed his own ultrasound. He said the thyroid is enlarged, and I have 3 good-sized nodules in the left center and right sides of the thyroid. The endocrinologist biopsied the 2 largest nodules and sent them off for testing. Since the thyroid was enlarged, he was talking about surgery to remove the thyroid. What are pros and cons of keeping an enlarged thyroid with nodules or having it removed? I know if the thyroid is removed, that will involve having to take thyroid hormones pretty much all my life. If left, would an annual blood test need to be taken to monitor hormone levels? Can eating certain foods or taking vitamins help? Just looking for other options before considering removal. Thanks for your input. Jonathan, I'm sorry you're going through this, and the decision to go for surgery or not isn't always an easy one, especially when you're not experiencing pain or a lot of other symptoms. Let's discuss your situation, but first, a little about the thyroid gland itself. The thyroid gland is positioned just in front of the trachea, the windpipe, just below the Adam's apple, and it produces hormones that help regulate your metabolism. The thyroid produces substances we'll call T4 and T3, that regulate growth, energy, and the body's utilization of other hormones and vitamins. The thyroid itself is regulated in turn by the pituitary gland in your brain, which tells the thyroid when to release T3 and T4. To underscore the complexity of this process, the pituitary gland itself is regulated by another gland, the hypothalamus. Thyroid disease usually involves a production of either too little or too much of the hormones from these 3 organs. Over 20 million Americans suffer from some form of thyroid disorder. Some thyroid problems that are common in third world countries today may one day become prevalent here in a post-collapse setting, which is why I've written about it from time to time. One condition you may be familiar with is a goiter. A goiter is an enlargement of the thyroid gland that results due to a deficiency of iodine in the body. We rarely see this in developed countries because we're able to obtain iodine in our diet. Indeed, it's the main reason that common table salt is iodized. A person may have a goiter without symptoms or even disturbed thyroid hormone levels. But you don't have a goiter, Jonathan. You have smaller masses we call nodules. These may be cystic, filled with fluid, or solid in nature. These masses are usually cold, that is, not producing hormones, and have no cancerous or major ill effect. Thyroid cancer is relatively rare, even in the elderly, unless there has been exposure to radiation. Increases in cases of thyroid cancer have been seen, for example, in children raised in the vicinity of the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown in 1986. Most occurred many years after the disaster. So, Jonathan, let's look at your results. You have a low thyroid stimulating hormone level, TSH, a clue that your pituitary gland is detecting too much thyroid hormone in your bloodstream and is slowing down its production of signals to your thyroid gland. It serves as a primary early warning symptom of hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid. But your thyroid T3 and T4 levels aren't high, they're normal. We sometimes call this subclinical hyperthyroidism. Now, sometimes a low TSH isn't caused by an overactive thyroid at all, but sometimes by a problem with the pituitary gland, which prevents it from producing adequate TSH. I should mention what the symptoms of hyperthyroidism are for the family medic. You should know what they are. Common symptoms include unexplained weight loss, even with an increased appetite, a rapid or irregular heartbeat, such as palpitations, nervousness, anxiety, and irritability, tremors in the hand, sweating and heat intolerance, difficulty sleeping, and muscle weakness. Because you feel a fullness where the thyroid is on your neck, a thyroid scan was ordered. You say there were 3 good-sized nodules without mentioning the actual measurements. The nodule greater than 2.5 centimeters in size is usually recommended for biopsy. In thyroid ultrasound results, sometimes you'll see something called TRADS. That stands for Thyroid Imaging Reporting and Data System Categories. These grades classify how suspicious a thyroid nodule appears on an ultrasound. They range from level 1, benign, to level 5, highly suspicious for cancer. And these are used by doctors to determine whether a nodule needs to be biopsied. They also evaluate the nodule's composition, solid or cystic, its shape, margins, and whether or not it contains calcifications, which is a bad sign. TRADS 1 and 2 carry very small or no potential for malignancy. At level 3 is mildly suspicious with a cancer risk less than 5%. And here's where size becomes important, with biopsies recommended at 2.5 centimeters. TRAD 4 and 5 nodules are somewhat irregular in appearance, with a cancer risk of 9 and 35%, respectively. These are almost always biopsied, even as small as 1 centimeter. High-risk nodules often feature solid composition, tiny calcifications, and very dark margins. But your biopsy results showed benign characteristics, as do the vast majority of nodules. Still, you were offered the removal of the thyroid, called thyroidectomy. There are important things to consider here. There's a small risk of false negatives. That means a biopsy needle may have missed the cancerous cells within the nodule, or the cells appeared benign under the microscope when they were not. The nodule size is also a factor. If a benign nodule is large, typically over 4 centimeters, some surgeons recommend removing it, not always because of concerns about cancer, but because the large nodules can cause compression, leading to difficulty swallowing or even breathing. Even after a totally benign biopsy, doctors usually recommend monitoring the thyroid with periodic thyroid scans and physical exams. Going this route preserves thyroid function and avoids lifetime medications. You also avoid the risk of general anesthesia or a surgical complication, although these happen rarely. Follow-up visits are usually done every 6 to 12 months, depending on the nature of the nodules. If you notice a nodule rapidly growing, a change in your voice, or difficulty swallowing or breathing, action may become necessary at some point. Some may ask, why would you want to undergo surgery? Some people have anxiety issues, and the fact that there are lumps that may one day become a major issue is too much for them. Also, if you're experiencing too snug, tight collar feeling that you were talking about, removing the nodules would probably help. You could consider asking about having only the nodules removed, perhaps removing half the thyroid. This would avoid your having to take meds long term. It depends on various factors, so ask the doctor. There's also a non-surgical method that's called radiofrequency ablation, or RFA. That's an emerging first-line option that uses heat to shrink nodules while preserving the healthy thyroid tissue. This requires only local anesthesia and leaves no scar. Unfortunately, there are no specific food or vitamins that are scientifically proven to suppress or shrink thyroid nodules. However, an anti-inflammatory diet and correcting nutritional deficiencies like iodine or vitamin D support overall thyroid function and may prevent nodule growth if it's caused by an underlying condition. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health and good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, don't forget to check out our entire line of quality medical kits and individual supplies at AltonFirstAid.com. You'll be glad you did.
All right, great stuff from Doc Bones. Let's move on now and talk about something more mechanical, less biological. Specifically, battery backup systems, and in this case it's for backing up power to freezers, which is a great place to have some backup power, but battery backup power can work for anything electronic, so this should help anybody listening who wants more backup power in their lives. And with that, I give you Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSB community. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I have a question from Nick, who's asking about connecting some LiFePO4 batteries for a backup system for his freezers. He says, I have a question about best practice for long-term backup battery storage. And his details are that he has 4 100 amp hour LiFePO4 batteries. They are stored indoors. They're in his basement, which is fairly consistent as far as temperature and humidity at 40% humidity. They are wired in parallel and connected to an inverter to run my freezers should power go out. And then he asked, can I use batteries to be connected to a battery tender running on grid power so that they are always topped off? Yes. And if so, is there one that your expert recommends? I do have some recommendations here. Yes. Do they need to be discharged periodically to increase longevity? I've been reading conflicting information on the internet and thought your expert might know. Hope you're doing well, and thank you, Nick. All right, so Nick, here is my basic answer to your question. One, yes, you can get a tender or a battery charger that will keep those batteries topped off. And as far as the discharging periodically, yes. There's a couple of things here. One, they don't necessarily always need to be charged to 100%. And if they're just sitting and not being charged and discharged, having them charged not quite 100% can be really beneficial and useful. But also charging them to 100% periodically is important. And the reason for that is that you want to bring them all up to their highest voltage level, and that's going to balance those batteries. Since they're in parallel, you want to push them all to that top voltage to make sure that they hit the same voltage together, and then they'll back down to a standard or float voltage that they need to be on for basically their full charge. That's also true for discharging all the way. Now, the chemistry of the LiFePO4 lithium iron phosphate batteries are less sensitive to the charge and discharge cycle, but having them always 100% topped can definitely do some damage. And running them through a full discharge and charge cycle periodically can be helpful in keeping the batteries balanced with each other in the parallel configuration. But you're right, the information online is extremely conflicting and kind of contentious. So that's my general recommendation, is periodically discharge them most of the way and then charge them back up to 100%. And that should help keep the battery's voltage really close to each other so that they work as efficiently as possible. So Nick, before connecting these, or if you've already connected these, I would recommend actually having them disconnected and charging each battery to absolute 100% before reconnecting them. That helps just reduce the potential for any misbalance between the batteries. I'm also going to include a video that Jack can put in the links, and I had it set to a certain timestamp, and in that video they show my preferred way to set up these types of batteries, these smaller LiFePO4 independent batteries, in proper parallel so that you get really consistent charging and discharging from each battery. I'm also going to include some links for different parts and pieces to this. So, Nick, I will include one that is just a battery charger only, but my preference is actually to use a battery charger slash inverter because it's a package system together, and that package system is actually going to work as a UPS. So it's going to run your systems from the grid through the inverter, and if power goes out, it has a 20 millisecond switchover. So it switches over essentially instantaneously to the battery system, and it's built to do this. This is its purpose, and it costs a little bit more than the charger only, but it's got a built-in pure sine wave inverter and a system to do exactly what you're intending to do with only one device instead of multiple devices connected together. So it's my preference, but it does cost a little bit more than the charger only. In setups like this, I prefer to fuse the batteries independently. And so I'm going to include independent battery fuses that basically just bolt onto the terminal. And so you can wire the batteries the way you would typically wire them, but there's a fuse in between each battery so that if one of the batteries has a short or has a problem or is for some reason pulling high amperage, it will cut that battery off first. So that's my preference, is to set each battery up with its own individual fuse and then also have a battery disconnect. So I'm going to include links to each of those items. And the battery disconnect that I'm including actually has a voltage readout too, which can give you some additional information as to where your batteries are sitting. Nick, thank you so much for the softball question, and I hope that helps you. I will include all the links so that Jack can put those in the show notes for you. If anybody else has questions on general homesteading, technical systems, water, movement, distribution, storage, things like that, anything homestead related, I'm happy to answer, but I really enjoy the kind of technical questions on some of these systems. So thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
That great segment, and I have all the parts that he provided links to in the show notes today. All you have to do is go look up today's episode, which again is 3867. The reason I always reinforce the episode number when I say something like this is you can literally go to the site and stick the episode number in the search box, and you might find something that has that number in it additionally, but you'll find the episode really, really easily. And if you do EPI-3867, you are definitely, or whatever number, you are always going to find it. And I think a lot of people don't realize how powerful the search functionality on the site is. Anyway, I've got all those things for you there if you want to see the parts he was talking about. Backup power is something we probably need to do another dedicated show to. Ryan would actually be a great person for that. Maybe I'll reach out to him and have him do a guest form, and we'll talk about building basic backup power systems. These are some of the most advantageous things that we can have. And I think one of the things we leave out of the discussion a lot, like you're going to power a freezer. Okay, the freezer has a certain amount of energy requirements. But in some situations, can you find ways that lower energy things will do the things the high energy things do when the power isn't being backed up, when it's just there? Here would be an example. I run a lot of ponds that require a pump to run, and those pumps are fairly low draw. My average pump's pulling about 80 watts, so it's not a huge amount of power. But what would require even less power, and I just haven't done this yet, something I've planned on doing, is put a great big shop compressor in, because now I got a shop air compressor, and then put basically a dump tank on it with a control module, and then vent, you know, about 3 PSI off that dump tank into my aquatic systems. I have a friend who does this, and he says his air compressor kicks on 3 or 4 times a day to maintain it. Well, a battery backup system could run an air compressor for maybe 2 minutes, 5 times a day or so for a long time. That would be a substitution of the thing providing the service that is a lower draw power thing. So maybe I'll reach out to Ryan with some thoughts on some things like that and see what we can come up with together. Now let's talk about something else. Talk about our health. We talked about thyroid health. Let's talk about total body health as it relates to fitness and nutrition and things like that. And so this question for Annie McCann was basically, what do I do? What program do I use? I love Andy's answer. It is Andy's version, I think, of my favorite response to a question. It always starts out with what? It depends.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I have been doing CrossFit since 2007. Do you need to do this? No, you need to do something. So, guys, I've been part of the TSP community since 2000. Oh man, when was it? Bruce Softgy introduced me to y'all in maybe 2009 or 2010. I've been listening and doing ever since. I have chickens. I had ducks. I hate them. So they all got killed by the coyotes. And yay, because I don't like it. I do garden, though I hate it. Right now, I just keep alive the volunteer garden. So the ones that could make it from year to year. Yeah, let's do it. Stay with me. But I don't know why. I just don't like gardening. The chickens, yes, I love. Preparing, yes, I love. I've got solar panels. I am one of you. I also want to be harder to kill. I also want to look good naked. I also want to enjoy my life into my 90s and not be a burden on my family members. So the question that I got today is, Andy, what program should I be following? And so, as Jack will always tell you, it depends. But here's the real answer. You should do the one that you will do. So is CrossFit ideal for everybody? No. Is biking ideal for everybody? No. Is running? No. If you find something that you will consistently do, that's better than doing nothing. Now, barring that, let's say you're like, hey, I will go out and jog. Perfect. Do it. Here's the other thing. You should do something to build muscle. at a bare minimum, get some dumbbells and do some deadlifts. I would probably do something like a thruster. It's where you squat and then stand and then push the dumbbells up into the air because you're squatting and lifting something. I would probably get a couple different sets so you could do some lifts at speed, but then also do super heavy. Like, I can't really do these. You want to struggle a bit. Now, I wouldn't do something where it's like a one rep max. That's for show. But what program should you follow? The one that you will do. What is it? I don't know. Actually, let me jump in the ChatGPT and see how many different programs are out there that you could follow. Oh man, I love ChatGPT. In the span of a really bad prompt, it then gave me a better answer than I even asked for. So there are over 500 major brands, commercial brands you could pick from. There are over 1,000 named strength programmings you could buy. There are more than 5,000 run cycle and endurance plans. There are more than 10,000 or close affiliates that you could join. There are over 100,000 people with their personal training licenses. I didn't know this. 250,000 fitness apps and online coaches. So just out of your phone. There's over 500,000 videos on YouTube, walking you through a program. So, and then customizable downloadable ones, it says there's a million. So there are so many things you could try. When you say, I have tried them all, I bet you haven't. Here's where I'm going to challenge you. Two things. One, if you're unsure what to do, email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. Let's chat. I will help you. No charge. I will just help you find a thing or at least a couple options for you to go try. Now, you have to put your big boy pants on and go out and try them. I can't make you do that. And that's actually one thing I really hate doing one-on-one coaching, because you'll give someone the advice that you know is good, and then they're like, nah. And you're like, dang it. I mean, why even work with me if you're not going to listen? So I just remove that completely and say, look, I'll help you for free. Don't do it because, you know, you're an adult if you don't want to do it. But if you really want me to be your guy, it's super expensive. And the moment you don't do what we talk about, then I'm out, because I just have better things to do. So there are so many things you could do. If you need help, I'm here to help you. Does it have to be any specific thing? No. Do the one that you'll do. It could simply be, I really enjoy working on my homestead. Great. Come up with a thing that makes it a little bit more challenging every day to give you some sort of feedback. Your body is the ultimate adaptation machine. It will adapt to the stimulus that you give it. If you give it desk jockey, then it's going to become the body of a desk jockey. If you give it couch cowboy, I'm just sitting on the couch all day, then you are going to reap that reward. If you eat the standard American diet, you will get the standard American diseases. If you do the standard lazy crap, you're going to get that. So do something. Do anything. All right, so here's the other thing that I'll offer you. If you're in the Woodstock, Georgia area, let me know. Hit me with an email. We'll get together. We'll do some fitness. We'll have a meetup, a survival podcast meetup. We'll talk chickens. We'll, you know, do that. But we'll put names to faces and maybe having some a local accountability through a community of things that we love, the TSP, that maybe that'll motivate you or give you some ideas or even accountability, somebody to go with. I know back in the days of the forum, or basically back in the days when there's only Facebook, you could find people easier and group up people easier. There was, like, I think the old forum had like the Atlanta meetup or something. But everyone does everything, and there's no great way to pull people together. So this is my attempt to say, hey, I'm a real-life human being that literally does the stuff you do through modern-day survivalism, and I'm also really into health and fitness. I'm here to help. If you're local, that makes it super easy. If you're not, then maybe I'll see you at the fall workshop. Guys, it doesn't have to be tough. You just have to do something consistently. Yes, that means invest every day. Just like you would dollar cost average into Bitcoin, you need to dollar cost average into your own health for later on in life. Otherwise, man, it will come back to bite you. Y'all take care. Again, Andy McCann, CrossFit Garage. You can find my website there, crossfitgarage.com. You can find me on YouTube at AndyMcCann42. I have my own podcast, Fitness, Food, and Finance. I am here to help. Y'all take care.
So my add-on to this is simply that any of them, because unless we're talking about something like, I don't know, the Twinkie Ho-Ho and couch surfing routine, any structured way of eating and creating physical activity in your life is better than the default or the average. Okay. And it actually made me want to look something up in my book and read just a paragraph to you. This is from chapter 6 of Laws of Life, book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life. And I'm just going to read just the paragraph, no context before or after it, because it fits here anyway. And here it is. So here is my question for you. Where do you think you'll end up if you live the way most people around you live? See? Now that sucks, doesn't it? I mean, you're not foolish enough to think that you are the exception, are you? You really don't think that if you live your life like the average person, you will magically end up with above average results, do you? Now, how that applies to what we just heard from Andy about with choosing a way to live, a way to exercise, a way to eat, is simply this. If you don't, go somewhere where there's large crowds of people, specifically people, you know, let's say my age or older, 50-ish, right? If you go to a place where everybody's in their teens, there's a lot more fat people than there used to be, but you can get away with a lot when you're 17, 18, 19, 20, even 25 years of age, okay? If you keep living the way that the average person does, by the time you're 50, I promise you it catches up with you. And all you don't have to go any special place. Just if there's a lot of people there in their 50s and older, just look around and say, do I want this for myself? Okay? They got there by just using the default code. That's how they got there. When you say, I am going to follow this routine for food and this routine for fitness, you immediately have separated yourself from average. It doesn't mean it's good enough. It doesn't mean that it'll make you like, you know, super built or cut or something. But it will make you better than you would be as a default. Then I'll tell you the other side of this. And I think this is the biggest problem that people have, especially with the exercise side of things. They either go too hard too early or too easy too long. And what I mean by that is people get into a fitness routine. They want instant results. I want it now. I want to look like the guy I saw on the advertisement when I signed up for this shit, and he's all cut, and he looks good, and I want to be like that in 2 weeks. And they don't really think that, but they act like they think that. And they go at it so hard that it hurts, and it hurts the wrong way. It's not just like something you have to get through. You actually do physical damage to your body, and your body's like, no, F this. I don't want to do this. And you will default to the worn path in your life, which is not doing anything. It's what you've been doing for a long time. Now you start doing so. It's much easier to go back down where the water goes where the gully is on the hill. All right? So that's problem one. Problem two is people that don't do that, and they begin to get in shape, and their fitness does begin to improve. And this is where somebody says, I tried them all and didn't work for me. When it gets easy, you need to make it hard. I think this is the biggest thing where people fail in their fitness. That, you know, they come up with this routine and they're exercising every day. And they get to where they can just do it. And they say, well, I'm not getting any better. Because it got easy and you didn't re-challenge yourself. And sometimes challenging yourself isn't just add more weight or add reps. It can be other things. When I did my presentation in Tennessee at Nicole Sauce's workshop this spring, what I had two different people do in two different ways is something called empty lung conditioning. And this is simply where we breathe in and out several times at a measured cadence, and then we expel all the air from our lungs, and then we do some sort of physical activity for some duration of time in an oxygen-deprived state, which increases the difficulty. And it doesn't, that sounds dangerous. Well, if you do it the wrong way, it can be. I had people basically inhale and exhale to a three count. So three in, three out, three in, three out, three in, three out. You got it? And after like three repetitions of that, full exhale, and then six count before you inhale. So like doing a push-up, a three count down, a three count up. You can survive without breathing for 6 seconds. I promise you. And I had the one guy doing push-ups, because he's a guy who could do push-ups. And I had the other guy who, I'll just say, you know, might know who he was if he was there, not in shape. All I had him do was walk and learn the physical control. And then you can begin to do the same thing with the empty lung. You go from 3 seconds to five. You go from 5 seconds to maybe 7 or 8. Maybe get up to 10 seconds of empty lung conditioning. which can be 20 seconds without breathing. You can do that too. And if you can't, don't go that far. So that's the thing about all these things. If you just push yourself 1% past what's easy, and every time that push is not enough and it becomes easy again, push another 1%, 2%, you can constantly improve. And there's a quote I have for you that goes along with this little talk. Perhaps ironically, but unplanned, it's from the same chapter as I just read to you from. It's one of my leadoff quotes for chapter 6. And chapter 6 in book 2 is, "Stand still and life will move you back." And the quote is from Ray Kroc, the guy that built McDonald's. And this is what he said: "As long as you're green, you're growing. As soon as you're ripe, you start to rot." And I'd like you to think about that. When we stop trying to improve, where the default is we've reached peak. And once peak is reached, there's only one place to go. And that is obviously down. So my big takeaway for you on this one is, you know, get motivated like Andy, go crazy, whatever, be all hyped up, but or not, but do something. And always know that you can be more than you are. Because when you stop trying to be more than you are, your only thing left to do is become less than you are. And that is, well, that's our final decline into the box. And I ain't ready yet. And I bet most of y'all aren't either. Let's go on now and talk about Juneberries with Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Sarah. She writes, "Chef Ken, we've got several Juneberry trees on our property. Every year we harvest far more fruit than we can eat fresh, and everybody tells us to make jam or jelly, and honestly, we don't eat much of either. If you have a large harvest, what should you do with it?" Well, I'm super happy that you're actually getting to your harvest of Juneberries before the birds or the disease gets to it. But Sarah, I think that's one of the best homestead questions I've received in a long time, because it asks us to think differently. And as a chef, I don't look at a 5-gallon bucket of Juneberries and immediately think about recipes. I think about options. How many different ways can I preserve this fruit while keeping as much of its character as possible, especially for the winter months? Now, before we go any further, let's make sure we're talking about the same fruit. Depending on where you live, you'll hear them called Juneberries, Service Berries, Saskatoons, or Shadbush. They're all members of the same family. Even though they look remarkably similar to blueberries, they're actually much more closely related to apples and pears. And let's be clear, I am completely daft when walking around with Kerry Brown. Yet he gives me confidence and assurance that what I'm foraging is safe to eat. If you have the opportunity to learn from him, please do so. He has inspired me to start looking around me and the abundance of food that is around us. It's crazy how many ornamental plants that there are on the side of the road that produce the best harvest. But if you aren't sure that you have a Juneberry, please don't ask me. Please ask other people who are far smarter than I am. However, once you've tasted a Juneberry, it's quite unmistakable. Most people describe the flavor as somewhere between a blueberry and apple, with these subtle notes that can remind you of like almond. It's a refined fruit, not overpowering, not intensely sweet, just beautifully balanced. And the first thing I tell any homesteader is not to rush to preserve the entire harvest. Enjoy some of them exactly as they are. Every preservation method changes the food. Freezing changes texture. Drying concentrated sugar. Fermentation transforms flavor. Those aren't bad. They're simply different. Before you change the fruit, spend a little time understanding what they actually are. Then I'd be moving on to freezing. And surprisingly, freezing may be the best preservation method that changes Juneberries the least. Spread them out on a sheet pan in a single layer. Freeze them individually before transferring them into a freezer bag or vacuum sealed containers. That one simple step prevents them from becoming this one giant frozen block. And throughout the winter, you can grab exactly the handful you need without thawing the entire harvest. That's one of those small techniques that makes a huge difference 6 months later. Now, the next preservation method I would reach for is dehydration. I think dried Juneberries are one of the most overlooked pantry ingredients a homesteader can produce. As the moisture leaves, the fruit becomes sweeter, the flavors become more concentrated, and they can store exceptionally well when kept cool, dry, and protected from moisture. Now they become ingredients instead of fresh fruit. Fold them into granola, bake them into sourdough, add them to oatmeal, mix them into trail mixes, hell, pulverize them into a powder and make pemmican. Carry them as a snack. It's great to preserve anything, we just need to remember to use it. To me, that's exactly what a homestead should be producing. Not just food, usable food. Food that we know well and we use throughout the year. Food that does not stay in a mason jar in the cupboard for 5 to 6 years and we don't even know what or how to use it at that point. Okay, so now the third direction I'd explore is fermentation. Not a vinegar, although delicious, but I'm looking at a beverage. June berries have been used for generations to make country wine. And if you're already keeping bees, I'd be seriously tempted to make a mead, a traditional mead with fermented fruit inside. One of the things I appreciate about a Juneberry is that they bring more than just sugar to a fermentation. They contribute color, aroma, a gentle fruit character that doesn't overwhelm the finished beverage. Plus, it has tannin, which gives an incredible balance to sweet and tart things that mead can produce. Like every fruit wine, you'll still need to pay attention to your sugar levels and acidity depending on the harvest, but they produce this beverage that's uniquely their own rather than simply trying to imitate grape wine. And honestly, that's one thing that I love about homesteading. Instead of asking how to copy commercial products, we start asking what this particular harvest does exceptionally well. Now here's where the chef in me starts to get curious. I've frozen the fruit, I've dried the fruit, I've even started a batch of wine or mead. If you need recipes, please reach out to me on bloodsugarshift.com. I can definitely help. Or listen back to the TSB archives for Jack's mead recipe. So, I've still got fruit left. That's where experimentation begins for me. One of the first experiments I'd like to run is sausage. Now, let's be clear. I haven't seen Juneberry become a traditional sausage ingredient the way you'll find dried cherries or apples in certain regional sausages. This is simply where my culinary brain will go. I would dry the berries first, chop them coarsely, and then fold them into a fresh pork sausage or perhaps a venison sausage blended with pork fat. Why? Because every great sausage needs balance. You've got richness from the fat, savory notes from the herbs and spices, salt, texture. The June berries would contribute little pockets of gentle sweetness and acidity that refresh your palate every few bites instead of making the sausage taste fruity. Whether the experiment succeeds or fails, I would still run it. Now, if you're bold enough to do it or try it, please reach out to me and let me know how it goes. If you want a starting recipe for sausage, please reach out to me as well. Remember, bloodsugarchef.com. This is just how good cooking evolves, and this is how great homesteads incorporate the foods that they harvest year-round into ideas that work. So, Sarah, thank you for your question. Take advantage of the food abundance when you have it, because it is not always there. Find ways to preserve it through the year and start thinking innovatively. You'll be surprised with some of the techniques you'll discover. Keep those questions coming in to bloodsugarchef.com. Thank you for everyone who has sent out questions. I truly appreciate it. And until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
Y'all know if he didn't say wine and meat, I was going to, but he did, so that's great. I'd also tell you the whole freezing thing. When you're making wines and meads, specifically meads where you're doing melimels, instead of squeezing the fruit, we're infusing the fruit during the fermentation of a mead, freezing fruit is a cheat code. It causes cells within the fruit to rupture. And what then happens is when you infuse that fruit, you get a much better extraction. So it's a step to preserve, but it's also a step to get a better extraction and things like that. Another option he didn't mention, but I'd be interested in what you could do with this, is an alcohol infusion. Whether it be something like you're purely going for the fruit and you're using something like a vodka and maybe a little bit of sweetener and you're making something more like a schnapps. Would be one way, and it'd be an interesting whiskey. And I know a lot of people like, whiskey should taste like whiskey. Well, yeah, it should, and it often does. And I probably wouldn't put like super high-end whiskey infusion here, but something that's nice to sip by itself, infused with this, and then, you know, it doesn't need to necessarily be over the top. It can be just enough to ground it with more floral fruity notes. And then you do something with that, like make a smoked old fashioned. Now, with the amount of berries that they have, that's going to be a few handfuls will do that for a year, but it's just another option. Also, the things that he said about drying it intensify flavors. A lot of times when you take a dried fruit and you use it in any kind of an infusion, you actually get a better flavor extraction as well. And then another option with the sausage, I'm glad he said that, because that was the first place my head went, like a venison Juneberry sausage with just enough pork fat to balance the leanness of the venison would be amazing. But now we can start playing with other things. So if we were to do something like take the dehydrated Juneberries and then before we put them into the sausage, rehydrate them and maybe use an alcohol infusion there, but maybe not pure. Maybe that would be too much. Maybe that would be over the top. So something like a cognac or an Armagnac, like duck Armagnac sausage, very well-known thing. But like you do, I've had cherry venison sausage. You used the black cherries, the little ones from the wild cherry tree. And those were dehydrated. And then they were infused with brandy. And that was pretty fantastic. And the guy that made it, I talked to him, and I said, you know, you could tell there was brandy there, but it wasn't overpowering. He said, well, what I did is it was half brandy, half water that I rehydrated them with. Lots of things you can do. And then the last thing that came up for me, as I met a person one time, and they said, would you like to try some of the cheese we make? And I said, well, yeah. Usually if you ask me if I want to try cheese, the answer is yes. And this person made, it was kind of toward like, I don't even know what it was called, but it was kind of toward the consistency of like a blue cheese. Maybe more like a feta, but not that dry and not quite as crumbly as a feta is. More like a blue cheese. And it looked like blue cheese, except with the blue was a little bit purple. And it was mulberry. And it was very good. And I would just think that whether it's a rehydrated or simply using fresh, a Juneberry cheese might be something you could look at as well. And I'm all with Ken here. We need to stop trying to make copies of commercial foods, which are largely boring anyway, and ask, what can this thing do for us with the other things that we have? And don't be afraid to incorporate it into things that maybe we normally wouldn't. Meats and berries, that sausage there, pair well. There's other ways to do meat and berry pairings, or making sauces, or integrating the juice from something like a Juneberry into a hot sauce, right? One of my favorite people out there and companies out there is the Kentucky Rebel Scum hot sauces, right? And they have one called Blackberry Skirmish, and it is awesome. You could have your own version of that, like a Juneberry. You could also do barbecue sauces. There's so many ways to do this. And I'll throw one last thing before I go on. I'm not a big sweets person, but I've never been a big over-the-top sweets person. So one of the things we used to forage our asses off for when I was a kid were blueberries. And everybody's grandma and aunt, what have you, mom made blueberry pie. I hate blueberry pie. And Paul Wheaton loves huckleberry pie. It's the same thing. I don't care what you say, Paul. Blueberry, huckleberry, it tastes the same once you make pie out of it. I think it's too sweet. It's too much. It's too much syrup heaviness. But what my grandma used to do was make a blueberry cake. It was kind of like a coffee cake, and it had a lot of similarities to like a blueberry muffin, but it was more toward like old school coffee cake with the crumbles on the top. And she'd make a big sheet pan of that with the blueberries in it, you know. And that was a treat. That was a dessert, but it wasn't this over-the-top syrupy sweet thing. And one more, why not? I just can't stop when I start talking about cooking. Take some honey and make a Juneberry-infused honey. Use that in cooking and as an accoutrement and stuff like that. Or make a hot honey that's also Juneberry infused. There's so much you can do here. That's an exciting ingredient, honestly, if you start to actually think about it from a standpoint of not what somebody else would do with it, but if you just set me free with it and say, figure out things, well, can I do it? And the last one might be go to AI and say, hey, I have Juneberries, and use some advanced prompting that I'm not going to go into that side of prompting today, because my next question is about AI and AI prompting, and it's my anchor question for the day. All right, so this question came in from Jamie, and he said, I was listening to 3862, and I paused to put the latest coffee and COVID email into Notebook LM. I got a 17-minute audio overview that's very informative. My question to you is, what prompt do you use for AI agents who are talking back and forth about the article? Thanks, and have a good day. I'm going to give you some, we call this like levels of use of Notebook LM. For those that are listening, like, what the hell's a Notebook LM? It is a AI tool put out by Google. I believe that it's original, now it's getting used for a bunch of things now, but its original purpose was mainly to help people study for exams and things like that. It was built for students. It's also now linked with Gemini if you have more of the advanced Gemini, but I'm going to tell you that you will have more flexibility and control if you actually go to Notebook LM and do the work for it there, at least for now, and to the things that you can do. There's a bunch of stuff it will do for you. It will make videos, two different distinct types of videos, kind of a cinematic that's like a higher-end imagery and more of like a storyboard video. And there's a lot of options and flexibility there. It will make PowerPoint decks for you, and depending on how good you get with that, they can be really crappy or they can be really good. And one of the things they've recently added, not when I say recently, a few months ago, that's fantastic with the PowerPoint stuff is if there's a problem with one slide, you can actually prompt it to fix that one slide. And in general, it will do so. Okay. But the question here is about the audio, and the audio is the strongest attribute that it has. And part of what I love about audio as a producer is I know how powerful it is as a learner. And the reason it is so powerful, it is the one type of deep media that we can truly absorb while doing something else. We can't really do anything that requires any attention or focus at all and watch video. Most of the time when we do something like that, we're really taking in the audio. And we certainly can't read. What I mean by that is if you are out in your garden pulling weeds, you can listen to something like you're listening to right now. You can't really focus on a video. So if you build something that is dependent on video, the observer, the learner, has got to focus on the video and the audio. All right? And you can certainly do more, but that person then has to be focused. The same with reading. And I think it's one of the reasons that reading is such a powerful tool for our brains, and we should all read. But it's also the case that if I'm driving down the road, I should not be reading a book if I'm behind the wheel steering. That is dangerous. Likewise, if I am in the garden pulling weeds again, I probably can't be sitting there reading and pull weeds. Audio, I can drive a car, I can work out in the gym, I can, you know, I can like pull weeds in the garden, I can be sitting on a deer stand with headphones in really low, don't turn it up and deer don't hear it, but you can certainly get away with it, right? You can certainly take a walk in the woods, you can drive in your car. And so audio has that flexibility. From the Notebook LM suite, it also takes, it is the thing it's best at if you learn how to do it. So here's the first hack. Think this to yourself. This is before we do anything advanced or complicated, just a very small tweak. When you go to make an audio in Notebook LM, you'll click and then you select and you decide what kind of audio you make. There's several different options. Let's stick with what they call deep dive for now. So one most people use, it's two people discussing it. It's a male voice and a female voice. Okay. You don't get control over who's who when you do what I'm about to tell you. Like, you can't say make the man this and the woman that. It won't listen to it. But what you should say to yourself, this is a, I use it for Jeff Woods' newsletters. That's why I take his newsletters in. And it's always about AI, and because he's corporate AI, it's always about AI in the workplace and AI leadership. So I think to myself, who would I most want to hear from about their opinion of this content and how it actually relates? So my go-to for Jeff is have one host act as a C-level officer in a mid-sized company, say of $25 to $50 million a year, who is actively integrating AI at their workplace, and have the other host act as a person who is a consultant that aids large companies in the integration of AI in the workplace. That alone changes everything about the discussion you're going to get. And then you kind of look at the length of the content. How much do you want to know? How much time do you have? Because your basic selections then is short, regular, and long. So if there's a lot of material, I'm going to default to the long. Most of the time, I stick to the kind of the average in the center. And if it's a really short piece of content, I don't want it to be drawn out and repetitive, so I'll go to the short end. There's some other reasons I'm doing the short version, right? But you also have the ability to have a debate. So if it's something that you would want to hear a debate on, who would you want to hear debated? And you can't say be female, be male. It won't let you do that for whatever reason. But you can say, I want the person that is pro this to be this archetype of person, and I want the person that opposes to be that. Oh, and then after you generate that and listen to it, you can swap those roles. I want A to be positive and B to be negative, and then I want B to be positive and A to be negative. And you get a better understanding of it. You can also have the idea completely attacked as a critique. These are all things that you can do, but if you really want to gain the most, if you have something like a book that you have in PDF, you can take that down by chapter. But another thing that you can do is do what I tell you to do a lot already. Use one AI tool to write prompts for the other AI tools. So I might do something like either go to Gemini or ChatGPT. And my first instruction, I want you to act as an expert in using the Google tool called Notebook LM for whatever purpose, like generating audio content. Designed to help people learn, be as specific as possible. I'll say, yes, I'll do that. I'll give you a bunch of bullshit and you just ignore it. Then explain what you're wanting and say, I would like to figure out what type of personas to have evaluate this for me. I have some audios that are going to be available. Actually, they're available right now at jackslaws.com. They go through every chapter of the books. And all you got to do is go. You don't have to have the books. You can go there and opt in and you can get access to them right now. And every pairing is different. On the punctuality stuff, for instance, one of them is a person who coaches people in excelling in business, and the other one's a retired military officer, right? The ones that I've done for the workbooks over building this workbook for workbook one is each, they're very short. These are 4-minute-ish per module. And they act as a person with a PhD in psychology for one host and a neuroscientist for the other. You start to see the flexibility here. Now, I know what you're thinking, like, that's a lot of work to save time, right? And I agree. Like, going to that level, there's a couple times you might do it. One would be this. For instance, I have a master prompt for Jeff Woods' newsletters. I always use the same personas. And I always have the same extended instructions for what I want done. Those were all developed in a crit discussion, which is kind of ironic since Jeff created the crit method with ChatGPT. Basically, the context is I get these newsletters, I want to listen to them, right? Roll, you're an expert in Notebook LM. Interview, ask me 3 questions, task, make me a master prompt I can use for these. So I had to do that work, which is way beyond a quick prompt to just spit it out. But then once it's done, now that master prompt is for that repetitive content. Like, in other words, he's going to send that out every couple weeks. So all I got to do is just drop it in there, drop that prompt in there, boom, go do some other shit. And when I need something to listen to or I have time, it's there waiting for me. Okay? If you are someone like me who's an entrepreneur and you're generating content, you want to make supportive adjunctive content, I went through, when I did the ones for the books, I had that discussion, and I had it come up with the pairings for every topic. And then those pairings were the only variable, so I just put the prompt into a document. Find X, replace with Y. Find Z, replace with A. And then it was the same prompt over and over, but all the changes were the personas. And the guides to how long and the aspects and the angles were all the same. So this is one of the most incredibly powerful tools that you can get your hands on. And unless you're doing things like I am, where you're doing a lot of high frequency, there's no real need to pay for the upgrade. All right. But even if you have the base level of Gemini that you pay for, it automatically increases your quotas and abilities with Notebook as well. So that's a good thing to know. But let's talk about some ways that you might use it, even if you're not an entrepreneur, but you just want to learn more, but maybe it's learning more for professional reasons. So most of us, when we, you know, we get older and we have jobs and we're doing things, unless you're like, you know, if you're, and I'm not putting it down because I'm a big fan of trades, unless you're out welding or something, if you're a professional in sort more of an office environment, there tends to be things that you need to stay aware of and newsletters you should subscribe to or new publications that come out, industry trends, things like that. Sometimes they're even circulated and sent to you by your boss. Like, I really think everybody should review this. Upload it, unless it's some internal document you're not supposed to share, right? And to talk to everybody like they're five sometimes, right? Obviously, if it's sensitive material, it doesn't go into a general purpose AI. But if it's like something from the ICCC or something, or IEEE or whatever, like BICSI, I'm going my old standards bodies, and they put this new thing out, then stick it in there and say, I want you to act as an industry expert in the field of telecommunications and cabling data centers and offices and discuss what this actually means. Understand, sometimes it will still make mistakes. Sometimes it still hallucinates. It's a lot better than it used to be. But the general overview, very, very powerful. So now the boss says, hey, everybody should review this. And everybody, blah, 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 bullshit, boom. And you don't do it. But you upload it. You issue a prompt. And if it's something you regularly get, you generate a constant prompt for it. And then when you're, you know, after lunch, when you take a walk around your campus before you go back to your desk, listen to it. And even then, just a quick review of it. You know, actually do scan it. Your understanding of it and your retention of that understanding will increase. So that's another way that it can be used. If you're currently getting through school, use it the way it was intended. You can, again, like I said, you can build PowerPoints and things like that for review as well. If you want to see how I do this, go to jackslaws.com, click on resources, opt in, and check out the resources for books 1 and 2, and specifically the audio side. The videos, I made them because it was easy to do, and I put them there for you to have. But, and there's PowerPoint decks, too, for review. But the audios are incredibly powerful. And like I said, you don't even have to have a copy of the book to opt in and be able to listen to them. And maybe that'll make you want the book if you don't have it yet. I don't know. Anyway, but that's how I use it. And I think the most powerful takeaway from that is control the length, control the angle, and control the persona. And controlling the persona is incredibly useful. And it allows you to actually come at the subject from multiple stances. If it was political, act as a Democrat, right? How about this? Act as a Democrat who generally would be opposed to this, but has been won over by the logic of the case, right? And have the other party swap over. Act as a Republican who you would think would beat. See what I mean? Like, there's a million ways to skin that. Now, actually, what's going to happen with the political side of that? All these AI tools lean left politically. But it's pretty interesting to listen to. I'll just say that. And then Notebook has something else. I haven't actually tried it enough to see if they've got it working yet, but there's actually like interactive now where if you, instead of downloading the audio, if you listen to it, you can actually talk to the hosts in the middle of the discussion. I don't think they've quite ironed that one out yet, but that's going to start getting really, really interesting. Again, incredibly powerful tool, but as always, prompt engineering is helpful, but what you know is what sets your prompt engineering apart and improves your overall experience. Instead of being told the way it is by AI, use AI as a discovery tool and a thought partner, and it becomes very, very powerful. And the very thing that people most worry about taking away their sovereignty technology becomes an avenue and a tool toward ultimate personal sovereignty. That's the way I'm using AI, and that's the way I've been trying to teach it for 3 years. Some of you shriek at me that it's a demon or it's going to be killing us all like we're all John Connor or something, and I don't have time for it. It's just another technology. It's just another tool, and the tool is only a tool. The skill lies in the hand of the carpenter. With that, guys, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Again, if you like what you heard today and you are new to the show, please subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use. If you're listening to this episode today, it is only on your audio platforms. We do three shows a week, and two of those three are on YouTube and other video streaming platforms as well. This one, because of the way I, you know, kind of merge everything together with the experts, it doesn't make it in a video. But we are available that way. And if you like some of the things you hear me saying and you haven't got a copy of my books yet, you can just go to Amazon, search for Laws of Life Spirko. That last name is S-P-I-R-K-O, Laws of Life Spirko. You're looking for book one, second edition, or you're looking for book two. And you do not have to read them in order. It might be helpful, but, you know, I wrote them both, and I'm going to tell you, book one, second edition is really good. Book two takes everything to another level. You can start with either one. Thank you for tuning in today, and I will catch you Tuesday next week with the Just Jack Show.
Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you.